to Innovation Alberta, a program about science, research, and the inventive spirit. I'm your host, Cheryl Croucher. On this evening's program, the School of Business at the University of Alberta offers an innovative MBA program with specialties in natural resources and technology commercialization. These are important fields of knowledge in a competitive global economy. And on the Oriented Strand Board front, new technology developed at the Alberta Research Council uses sound waves to improve the quality of these panel boards and could save OSB mills thousands of dollars each day. And historian Sandy Gao has more stories about innovations and inventors from the early days of Alberta's oil patch. All this coming up in the next half hour on Innovation Alberta. Two innovative MBA programs at the University of Alberta School of Business are preparing students for the challenges of a global economy. One deals with technology commercialization. It's not easy getting new developments from the lab to the marketplace, yet getting there first is critical to success. The other deals with energy and natural resources, an important field of study in a world seeking to balance the relationship between resource use and the environment. Dr. André Plourde is the Associate Dean for MBA programs at the University of Alberta School of Business.
So far, the research has typically focused on three things. There are people who've been looking at electricity deregulation in Alberta. It's a topical issue. Some people have been looking more at energy-related questions, and some people have looked at environmental issues and linkages, especially within the context of the energy sector.
Well, let's look at that last one, the environmental sector. What are some things that are going on there?
Well, for example, there's somebody closely aligned with the program who is part of the consultation team, if you want, for the Canada's Kyoto strategy. So that essentially, in terms of whenever there's negotiations going on in the world, he's off with the negotiating team trying to understand what's going on or get a view of where things should be going. So that there's a lot of connection directly to that side of the environmental issue. Some of the research that I've been doing, for example, also links to some of that, where what we're trying to do is to look at kind of demand responsiveness within the energy the energy sector. So if you change prices of the various energy forms, what happens? And the underlying theme of this is to get a feel for how easy it might be or hard it might be to move to off crude oil or coal or those kinds of issues.
Well, what things have you actually looked at and found out in this particular study?
So the study we're doing right now is to try and get and develop a methodology that would allow us to look at changes in prices of energy sources and the response of consumers. There's some literature on the idea that consumers typically respond more strongly to price increases than to price decreases. And so we wanted to look at that to see whether this is true. These types of studies have typically only looked at one energy source at a time, whereas we know that when we think of all of this, people decide to consume energy in different bundles in different sources all at once. So we wanted to try and get a feel for how much that mattered. What we've been finding so far is that there is some evidence that people do respond more to price increases than to price decreases, but the differences so far have not been very large. And surprisingly, for example, in the case we looked at, which is data for Ontario, as it turned out, not much in oil demand, but much more, for example, in electricity and in natural gas demand.
When do you expect this to be finished?
Oh, it's with my co-author right now. We have a final draft, and there's some minor changes to be made, but basically all the results are in. It's just a question of polishing up what's there and sending it off to a journal.
Now, you've also just returned from Cuba. You've been teaching a course down there on energy. What's that all about?
This is old contacts from coming back to haunt me a long time ago. A colleague of mine is interested in in development economics, and some years ago we went to Africa to do something, and then this came back as another opportunity. The idea here is that the Cuban government has developed an interest or is very interested in kind of linkages between energy and the environment, especially because for them generating electricity is something that really matters and is very difficult. They don't have natural hydropower. They have very limited technology in alternative generation. Most of what they have is some kind of oil-based thermal electricity generation. So, and the environmental consequences are pretty nasty of this because of the technology they've got. So they wanted to understand a bit better the linkages between the environmental consequences of their energy development, but also exploring alternative ways of meeting their energy needs.
So what did you tell them?
Oh, in part that there are two things they should think of. There is a lot of cogeneration opportunities in Cuba. They produce a lot of sugar, and at the end product of sugar is something that could be burned to generate electricity. And so you could possibly, in an ideal world, kind of revamp the old sugar mills that they've got and introduce some kind of cogeneration plant that would at least meet the electricity needs of the sugar industry without drawing from the national electricity grid. So that might reduce. The other thing is that there are possibilities in terms of wind energy. Wind energy has requirements that are pretty specific. Cuba is an interesting place because it's not very thick, so that essentially as the energy, you could put windmills on the coast, which for some reason, actually because of the characteristics of the wind, might work quite nicely, but you're not very far from the grid at any point in time, so the losses are relatively low. It might be something that they could be interested in looking at.
So then if you come back to your experience in Alberta, what do you have or what do we have that we could offer the Cubans?
Well, at this stage, I think it's pretty clearly technology. It's probably entertaining for them to have somebody like me going to talk to them. It's very different, I would think. But what's really required in order for them to make a step ahead is access to technology. Most of what they have functioning right now either predates the revolution or is of Russian USSR type of construction that has not been maintained very well since at least since the end of the 1980s. And so I think technology is really what matters at this stage.
What is the importance of technology?
Well, the focus of this is another specialization within our MBA program, and the focus of this specialization was actually to capitalize on a relative strength of the university. The university has strong pure sciences, medical, and medical researchers. With a lot of cases, with somebody in a lab coming up with a new molecule, not knowing how to get it from the lab to market. And so people in the Alberta Research Council and other places were hoping to find a way of generating kind of people who had a better business background who could help. I know it sounds patronizing, but I don't mean to, kind of assist the transition process from the lab into the market. And so somebody came to us with this, we decided that a proper response to this would be to create a technology commercialization program. So in the early days, the basic argument for this was, again, to respond to a perceived need to capitalize on relative strengths of the university. So the focus of the technology commercialization MBA was very much on biotechnology, going from molecules, if you want, from labs to markets. More recently, we've had a number of students interested in other issues as well, more in information technology and that kind of thing. So the program has expanded in those areas as well. But the beginning idea was to help the transition from the lab to the market.
What's unique about the way that this MBA program is set up?
Well, if you take, for example, both the two specializations we've been talking about, natural resource and energy and technology commercialization, one thing that's different that students would not get elsewhere is we help them set up summer work placements in the industries that they're interested in. So that, for example, a technology commercialization student would come in, do a year's worth of coursework, and then would have a 16-week work placement with a firm in the tech or an organization in the technology commercialization area. They'd have to produce a report at the end of the year and then come back to do their study. So you hope that they learn a little, they learn some from an academic background, but they also get right into the industry for part of their training. And so when they're finally graduated a year later, they've both got solid background from an academic perspective, but they've also got first-hand experience in the real-world concerns and challenges of the sector that they're interested in.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
I was speaking with Dr. André Plourde, the Associate Dean for MBA programs at the University of Alberta's School of Business. Coming up, acoustic ultrasonic technology, a new tool for quality control. One of the big success stories for the Alberta Research Council has been the development of oriented strandboard. OSB is made from wood chips and resin, which are pressed under heat to form panels. These can be used in building construction. OSB technology has spread around the world and is well integrated into the construction industry. Now, the Research Council has made a major breakthrough in improving the quality of oriented strandboard. This also promises to save manufacturers thousands of dollars each day. To find out more, I spoke with Dean Richardson. He's an account manager in the Technology Commercialization Office of the Alberta Research Council.
The challenge with an OSB mill is to manufacture as efficiently as possible, and one of the key steps in the manufacturing process is the pressing step, which is towards the end of the manufacturing process, where the OSB board is, the mat it's called, is put into a press and then subjected to pressure and temperature to cure and come up with the final form. The issue now is that often the presses have to stay clamped longer to ensure a proper cure on the OSB product inside the press.
Is that because they don't have any way of telling how long it needs to cure?
That's correct. In some respects, you can liken it to baking a cake, because if you're not sure about what's happening inside the oven and you can't read the temperature, you're going to tend to be opening the oven door and checking it a lot more and leaving it in a little longer just to make sure it's cooked all the way through. This is analogous on the OSB press as well.
But you guys have come up with a solution here at the Alberta Research Council, and it has a pretty fancy name. What's it called?
The name of the process is acousto-ultrasonic monitoring of resin curing. That's a long mouthful, but really what we're talking about is using the way sound would transmit through the board to determine the state of the resin cure inside the press. The analogy is if you're tapping on a countertop, you get a very visible and noticeable sound return. If I were trying to do that equivalent tap on a sponge, you're not going to hear anything because the sound attenuates. Similarly, inside an OSB mat, you know, at the time of going to press, you've got a bunch of resin floating around inside where these strands are. They tend to absorb the sound, but as the resin cures and as the mat gets compressed inside the press, it hardens, and then you start seeing the acoustic sound coming back. And what our scientist, Dr. Li Heng Chen, has come up with is an approach to measure the acoustic response in such a fashion that we can correlate that with the state of the resin cure inside the mat.
Well, how would you actually do that? What's the setup?
In essence, we inject a sound signal on one end of the press, and we receive it on the other side of the press, and we track that signal attenuation over time. A typical press cycle might run 180 to 200 seconds. We'll track through the course of that and measure the process in real time. We'll capture data in real time and process the signal and come up with an acoustic return. Dr. Chen has determined a correlation between the bond strength inside the panel and this acoustic response, and that can provide immediate and direct feedback to the press operator to tell them when to open the press.
Well, looking at the pictures that you've shown me, it looks like a pretty simple setup. You have a computer and then a few wires or things. Is that exactly the way it works?
More or less, although there's some complexity in the detail, but in essence, you've got to make sure you get the signal into the mat in a fashion that you receive some return coming out of it. So there's some complexity in the coupling, it's called. There is also, as you can appreciate, there's a lot of noise inside a mill, and so when I speak of noise, I'm talking about electrical noise and electrical activity that can send, in receiving equipment can cause a lot of different signals, and so there's a certain amount of signal processing and filtering to make sure we extract the right information from all of this data. And I guess the third element is it's got to be tough enough to withstand, a fairly harsh environment in terms of, you know, getting bumped about and so on. So there's several items, you know, that we've got to deal with in terms of making it suitable for an industrial application.
Well, looking at the ability to cut down on the cure time, what does that actually mean for the mills?
There could be some substantial returns from a mill's perspective. One of the issues, as we talked about earlier, is we tend to go long in the press cycle in a mill because we're not sure what's happening. We want to make sure we get a proper cure. Currently, what the industry does is it'll tend to every so often pull a panel out of production, take it through a destructive testing process to see how strong the panel is, and if they find they've got a problem, well, by that time the presses continue to run while they're doing the destructive testing, and they could have produced a lot of off-standard product, in the time if their press isn't functioning correctly. So what we can do is, with this technology, we can test in process and make sure the product stays on specification. And in addition, we can also reduce the total cycle time on the press itself. Now, in a large capital-intensive mill, if you can help them improve their asset utilization, that is, if you can reduce the cycle time on the mill, they can then get more units of output for a given period of time. And that translates directly into improved equipment utilization. And that, in turn, can significantly improve their cash flows. Our assessments are that with the technology can probably reduce press cycle times on the order of 5 to 15 seconds per cycle. That can translate into 5 to 10 more press loads per day or per shift, per 12-hour shift, which in turn can mean anywhere from $5,000 to $10,000 per day additional throughput, additional dollars into the mill. So that's a pretty significant return from their perspective, and I think that's why we've had such strong interest from industry.
Where did the idea for this originate?
Well, probably there was some core work done at the NASA facility, one of the NASA facilities stateside, 25 to 30 years ago. That was picked up on and extended into a number of sort of non-aerospace areas, one of which was the Forest Products Lab at the University of California, Berkeley, where Dr. Chen was doing his graduate degree. He's one of the co-inventors of this technology in its application to composite wood fabrication and processing. Then Dr. Chen came to the Forest Products Business Unit here at the Alberta Research Council, and ARC licensed in the patented technology that he had developed there, applying this technique to composite woods. And it's been extended since then to be able to take it into a mill environment.
How is the oriented strand board industry responding to this new technology?
Very positively. This has been one of the one of those instances where we've had a lot of industrial interest from a number of different players. We've recently signed an exclusive licensing agreement with a very large resin manufacturer to this technology, because they're a resin vendor. I mean, the technology to measure resin cure is a natural fit for them, and so they've elected to step up to the plate with us at a fairly early stage in the product's development, because we still need to go through detailed trials in a full mill setting. We've done pilot plant tests and a variety of other approaches to commercialize the technology, but these folks have come forward early because they want to be involved in the scale-up and the extension of the technology into a mill setting.
Well, that's a pretty strong vote of confidence for technology that you're still testing out.
Absolutely. I mean, it's a very strong endorsement, and it was one of the ones that we used internally inside the Research Council to ensure that we did have viable technology that had a place in helping Alberta industry compete. And so we took that as a strong endorsement and used it in our internal assessments to validate and elect to continue to invest in this particular technology.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
That was Dean Richardson. He's an account manager in the Technology Commercialization Office at the Alberta Research Council. Next, a step back in time. By the 1960s, searching for oil was getting harder and required more specialized equipment. As historian Dr. Sandy Gao explains, it was a time when the spotlight could finally shine on the inventors in Alberta's oil patch.
Well, there was a lot of drilling going on, and the drilling business went through a series of ups and downs, as I explain in the book that I've written. And you're looking for oil, and you start by looking for it in the easiest places to find, and you're using the technology you have at the time. However, as oil gets harder to find, you have to improve the technology, and you have to go looking for it in places where you normally wouldn't expect to find it. And that meant that a lot of the seismograph equipment and the geological techniques and the oil well drilling techniques had to be improved. And it's about this time that Canadians, who have been working for Americans for so long and have learned how to handle the equipment, and they know what's wrong with it and they know what they want in a good model, begin to come on the scene. So in the 1960s, you get downhole motors, for example. A Canadian by the name of Wentzel began making major improvements to an American-style downhole motor. And those are the kind which can drill at angles now for directional drilling. They'll go down and then they'll go off at an angle so that you can be sitting back from the Rocky Mountains 2 or 3 kilometers. But you drill down straight and then you begin to go at an angle and you pull oil out from underneath the mountains because it would be impossible to drill in them. So Wentzel's downhole motors were a big start for Canadians in that particular time period.
Well, it sounds like just getting the equipment down the hole poses quite a big problem, and that there's lots of inventions and innovations that go on in this area.
Yes. Drilling the hole is sometimes the easiest part. But then you want to find out if there's anything down there. You don't necessarily, the old picture of the gusher coming shooting out and all that, those are long, long gone. Number one, they're hazardous. Number two, they waste a lot of good oil. So what you want to do before you have that gusher or bump or kick, as it's called, you want to try and determine if, in fact, there is oil where there seems to be oil. Because intuition, drillers relied a lot on intuition in the early days, but as drilling got deeper and more complicated, they weren't able to. So people like... There was a man by the name of Dom Zerb and Murray Varty, who lives here in Edmonton. They developed the Cougar Tool Company, and they developed what was called a shock sub for taking some of the shock of drilling downhole. And Site Oil Tools developed oil tools which would tell you what was in the bottom of the hole. And Horizon Well was a logging company with a Canadian leader. And Keith Banks, a former employee of the American giant Schlumberger out of New York and Houston, developed a radioactive tool to detect oil in very thin zones, such as what we'd have out at Pembina in the Drayton Valley area. And this was so accurate that it could see right through the steel casing and tell you if there was oil nearby. Other people like Wally Kucher at Tri-Service Machinery in Edmonton here developed all kinds of innovations for drilling rigs and service rigs. There was really no shortage. And two men, Jerry Knoll and Matt Baldwin, of Baldwin and Knoll, they're very well-known names in Alberta, built service rigs. These men designed and built the rigs for doing well workovers when you had a well that you wanted to clean out and things like that. So that, along with things like the best desilter on the market today that takes the silt out of the mud, which you recirculate out of the hole, is made in Canada. It's made and supplied and designed here. And the best oil field treaters called Free Flow are built in Estevan, Saskatchewan. The treater separates out the water and the gas and the other impurities.
Well, in the early days, when you look at the pictures of the oil rigs themselves, they're made out of wood today. You know, they're all metal. What was it like building these rigs, and how have they changed over time?
Well, the wooden rigs initially were made from BC fir, and fir was fairly cheap. It was cheaper to buy than an iron derrick, which came to be called conventional derricks. And before something called a service rig came along, when you wanted to clean out your hole with paraffin wax, or you wanted to do anything to the producing material at the top, the equipment, you left that wooden derrick over the hole, and you hooked up your servicing equipment, all your pulleys and all that, and you pulled all the rods out and cleaned the thing and put it back together again. But when the service rig came along, you no longer needed that derrick there. And one of the problems with the wooden derricks is they were reasonably strong if properly built, but in southern Alberta, in particular, they tended to blow over. You could get a really bad... There were no guy wires, you see. For the most part, you didn't secure them in any way. And they were literally sitting there free without being secured. And one year in Turner Valley, one wind blew over about 8 of them, just in a matter of about an hour. But in the end, when the service rigs came along and you no longer left the derrick there, it became obvious that a much better way to do it was to use a metal derrick. And so people call rig builders, of whom there is one of the old-style rig builders retired out at Leduc, Mr. Vern Kerber, and he explained to me how he put these rigs together. And usually four men working together simply put planks across it, and they built a tower, like a water tower. And that turned out to be your drilling rig. But when you wanted to go on to the next job, you pulled that thing all apart, put it back on a truck or a rail car, trucked it away, and put it back up again. But they were much more durable.
So what allowed them to make the switch over to using metal?
Cost, in part, because the cost of the metal dropped. Initially, a drilling rig, a conventional rig made of metal, was very expensive because there weren't enough being called for. But once you began to mass produce them, then the price began to drop. You ordered them from the United States like you would the old Meccano set. You know, you got the whole thing, and every nut and bolt, et cetera, was there, and the plan to put it together. And they were made by anywhere up to about 20 different companies in the United States. We never made those conventional derricks in Canada. We went directly to making our own jackknife rigs, as they were called, ones that folded over and could be broken up into parts and carted to the next job. They were much faster. It took up about roughly 3 days to put one of those together. That was a long time. And the wooden ones took longer because you had to drive them together with spikes. They were also a fire hazard. The wooden ones would burn down in just literally seconds. You know, they would catch on fire.
Dr. Sandy Gao is a professor of history at Concordia University College in Edmonton. He's writing a book on changes in oil drilling technology. And thanks to the Alberta Historical Resources Foundation for sponsoring this segment of Innovation Alberta. That brings Innovation Alberta to a close for this week. Innovation Alberta will return in a couple of weeks when the CKUA fundraising drive is over. In the meantime, you can catch up on previous programs by tuning in to our website. That's at innovationalberta.ckua.com. Technical producers for Innovation Alberta are Scott Franchuk and Paul Pates. I'm Cheryl Croucher. Good night.